Good evening and thank you. What are we going to do this evening? Does everyone have a translation of the Dead Sea Scroll in their lap somewhere? At their seat? Can you get it back there? But I'm wondering, Mark, why don't you grab a few and pass them out to people who raise their hand and don't count them? Great. Last week, every one of our sessions is going to begin with a commercial. Go ahead and hold your hand up if you don't have a hand up. We're going to begin with a commercial, and then we're going to do a little bit of review of what we talked about last week. Then we are going to finish the story of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 20th century, and then what we're going to do is move on to start to talk about the impact on the Dead Sea Scrolls, our understanding of Judaism at the time of Jesus, and the growth of the Bible, the formation of Scripture. And the way we're going to get into that this time is by reading this Dead Sea Scroll together. And we're going to have some interaction back and forth as we read the Dead Sea Scroll together this evening. So, okay, that's what we're going to do. And does anybody else need a handout? I'm getting a lot of buzzing with this. Does it sound okay? Okay, I'm going to turn off the lights in a second so we can, I hate to say it, see the commercial.
Can you leave all the lights on because we have 7 minutes of you talking on the dock?
I'm going to leave one string on.
Okay. Now, as again last time, I direct a nonprofit research organization called the Early Manuscripts Electronic Library that's devoted to creating digital copies of ancient and medieval Christian and Jewish manuscripts. I talked a little bit about that last week. I'm going to take another couple seconds to give you another commercial tonight. But the commercial is relevant to our understanding of manuscripts, Christian and Jewish manuscripts, how that research occurs, how they become accessible. Last week I talked about the system we spent 2 years engineering for digitizing fragile codices. Those are books, bound manuscripts. Now what happens when a manuscript is damaged? Due to water damage, due to damage by fire, or actually one of the things that happened in the Middle Ages was that, well, writing material was extremely expensive, so it needed to be recycled. And medieval scribes had recycling programs in scriptoria, the area of monasteries where manuscripts would be copied. And they would take an old manuscript that had fallen into disuse and erase it. Normally, they would take a pumice stone and scrape the parchment pages so as to take the top layer of parchment away and remove most of the ink. But just like erasing pencil with an eraser on the end of your pencil today, that erasing process was imperfect. And normally they call these palimpsests, these recycled, twice-used pieces of parchment. And normally you can see the top layer, the secondary text, perfectly, of course. And the under layer sort of just hints at you that it's there. You can tell it's there, but to actually read it as intelligible running text is almost impossible. Well, of course, what the vast majority of palimpsests, what scholars are interested in, is not what it says on top. Because that may be a manuscript from the 15th century, maybe it's the 1,000th copy of the homilies of St. Chrysostomos from the 15th century. But often what's in the bottom layer, the erased layer, could be 7th, 8th, or 9th century. An extremely important text of only which a few copies have survived. But how do you read it? And that's where before digital cameras and digital technology, we used at the time infrared film and ultraviolet light. And there were problems with those technologies. One is infrared film, which sometimes certain kinds of ancient ink, you could see more clearly under infrared. But infrared film is like trying to shoot a sparrow with a shotgun. It grabs a huge area of the infrared spectrum of light. So it's not very precise in being able to make the manuscript legible. Matter of fact, some Dead Sea Scrolls, if the Dead Sea Scrolls deteriorate, they go from nice tan-colored manuscripts with black ink to solid black. The most deteriorated Dead Sea Scrolls are coal black. You can't even see if there's any ink on them whatsoever. And the technique that's been used to make them legible, well, they were using infrared photography when they were first discovered and got excellent results. Since then, we've used a technique on the Dead Sea Scrolls called multispectral imaging, where you take images You have the spectrum of light, sort of visible spectrum in the middle. One direction goes to infrared, which we can't see. Other direction goes to ultraviolet light, which we can't see. But with multispectral imaging, you take images in narrow selected areas in the spectrum of light. And then use software to combine information from different images to try to find a way to read the legible text. And I actually had the honor of being the project manager, not the scientist. I was the guy who ran around and got everybody's plane tickets and also wrote the grant proposals. But I was the project manager in 94 and 97 on the first application of multispectral imaging to ancient manuscripts, and that were Dead Sea Scrolls in Jerusalem, where the naked eye couldn't even tell if there was any writing on these documents. And often what we would have in these extremely deteriorated cases with Dead Sea Scrolls, that you would have a hunk of Dead Sea Scroll material. It would be about almost a fourth of an inch thick. It was layers of an ancient scroll that had turned solid cold black and basically agglutinized themselves together. And it was solid. If you tapped it on something hard, you'd shatter it. But this was an extremely fragile and deteriorated Dead Sea Scroll. And we would slide it under the digital camera, having isolated an area in the infrared spectrum, actually, where Dead Sea Scrolls, we brought this huge set of technology from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena to do multispectral imaging, where you take an image in this area of the spectrum and this area of the spectrum and combine them to get the reading. We found, actually, that if we could hit a certain area in the spectrum of infrared light with Dead Sea Scrolls, perfect legibility. So we were able to use a medium format digital camera, one infrared filter, and get perfect legibility on these documents. And you would slide an agglutinized Dead Sea Scroll blob, one of these solid coal black pieces, under the digital camera. And in real time, as you're pushing it, and I didn't push it, the conservators at the museum in Palestine, where most of the scrolls are, we would just point and they would take tweezers and handle the fragments for us. I didn't want to take responsibility for touching them. And they would push it under the camera. And as the fragment came under the camera, we could see it moving on camera on the computer screen. And what the visible light, your naked eye saw being pushed with tweezers, was solid cold black. And what appeared on the computer monitor with just an infrared filter on a digital camera was a white background with perfectly black ink like it came off a laser printer. It was fantastic. And then, since these were sort of a glutenized blob with multiple layers of parchment, you could see the top layer perfectly. A layer down below that looks sort of like ghost writing. And then you would flip it over, an image from the back, and get ghost writing from the back as well. So if this agglutinized blob was four layers of Dead Sea Scroll, we knew we could get three of those layers. One from the back, two from the front, and make them legible for the first time. And there was one Dead Sea Scroll that's quite famous called the Genesis Apocrypha. It's well preserved in terms of spatial area. I mean, most of the Dead Sea Scrolls, if we had a 22-foot long scroll, we only have less than 10% of the surface area that scroll survives for us to the present day. It's scattered fragments. But this scroll, I'm guessing, I've seen it, it's about 15 feet, 12 to 15 feet long, let's say. Continuous parchment. But when you get close to it, it's chocolate brown. It looks like someone poured molasses on it and then baked it. You can tell the writing is there, but boy, is it hard to read. In that sense, like a palimpsest, you can tell it's there, but the writing is dang hard to read. And as the Genesis Apocrypha deteriorates, there are two things that happen. The ink had iron gall in it, and the iron digs right through it, deteriorates the way it penetrates the animal heart. There are places where, if we could do this, if it was appropriate to do it, we could hold the Genesis Apocrypha up to a light and shine light through the parchment and see the text, because the ink just eats right through the parchment. Although, as it keeps eating, it starts out looking like a letter, but as it keeps eating, it makes a blob or a hole. So that doesn't help you that much. And then the other thing that happens as it's decomposing, and it's gelatin. The Genesis Apocrypha is decomposing to gelatin. And when we were working on it with multispectral imaging, I was standing next to a Dead Sea Scroll scholar who was quite senior, and I was a graduate student, so I was the person with, you know, wet behind the ears. But he was just the kind of personality who's touchy. Every time he always has to touch something he's looking at, and he kept reaching down and touching the Genesis Apocrypha. and I was pretty sure that one of his fingerprints was left in the decomposing chance apocryphon. So I just reached over to the senior scholar and grabbed his hand. And now as we stood there and looked at the apocryphon. But there was a section of the apocryphon, and it is saying what it is. The Genesis apocryphon is a retelling of the book of Genesis. The biblical book of Genesis is in Hebrew, and we're familiar with it to some degree. And if you're not familiar with it, Genesis is just fantastic stories, and read it like a story. But the Genesis apocryphon retells the book of Genesis in Aramaic, which was the general language spoken in Jewish homes at the time. It's in Aramaic. It retells the story of Genesis. But it adds vignettes about the characters that aren't in our Bibles. Now, there's no historical validity at all to these expansions of the text in the Genesis apocryphon. It's sort of legendary material that attached itself to the names of the characters. But it gives a running commentary on how someone... We think the Genesis apocryphon was probably written at about 250 B.C. The copy of it that's in the Dead Sea Scrolls is about 75 to 100 B.C. But it gives a running version of how did a Jewish person in the centuries immediately preceding Jesus understand the book of Genesis. And we can see it right there in the expansions of the text. We see how they understood the theology of Genesis. Let me give you an example of some of the interesting parts. And I'm digressing way off topic, but I think this is a piece of material. When did sin and death enter the world? Garden, story of Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve. Not according to the Genesis apocryphon. The primary moment, the big moment, when sin and death enters the world, there's a little verse. And if you read Genesis chapter 6, the story of the flood and Noah's Ark, and in verses 1 through 4, there's this verse that's horrible to try to interpret. It says, one of the reasons that God had to send the flood was because the sons of God had children with the daughters of men, and their children were the Nephilim. That's the Hebrew word, and actually we don't know what it means. But the Septuagint, an ancient Greek translation of the Bible, called them giants. So the sons of God had children with the daughters of men, and there were giants in the world according to the Septuagint. What does that mean? Who are these sons of God? And if you don't know what it means, I think it was a problematic verse to people at 200 B.C. Already, they were far enough from the writing of Genesis that the verse was problematic to them. So, in order to explain the verse, they developed whole stories to the background of that verse. And I actually believe some of those stories are the real background of that verse, and show a historical memory of what that verse meant to the writer of Genesis, but I think it got developed too. Now, that verse, you think of, you're the ancient Israelites in a polytheistic context. All the nations around you are polytheists. Matter of fact, if you read the Hebrew Bible, most of the people of Israel were polytheists. And that's one of the things Jeremiah got so upset about in his prophetic book of the Bible, was saying, there's only one God, that God is Yahweh, and the other gods are to be set aside. But the primary insight of monotheism is there is an ultimate distinction between creator and creation, a fundamental, ultimate, and unbridgeable distinction between creator and creation. Now, if you go to the Greeks, humans and deities have children all the time. And there used to be a show on Saturday afternoon on TV, The Adventures of Hercules. He's a hero. But the story of Genesis looks and says, looking at the polytheistic myths of the culture around it, and says those stories of sons of God having children across that unbridgeable gap between creator and creation with the daughters of men, that is a violation of nature. That is a violation of the monotheistic instinct. And that's one of the reasons God sent the flood, because the order of the world breaks down if divine and human have children together. So it's a response to the polytheistic myths of the culture around them, saying that is not the way the world works in a monotheistic consciousness. Does this make sense? So we see the background of an early Christian understanding of Genesis that we didn't understand until we have the Jewish texts that are the context out of which Christianity arose in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So Genesis part one, but when we applied multispectral imaging to make it legible, there was a line that had proved impossible to read because of deterioration. And there were two scholars in Israel who didn't like each other very much. In scholarship, academia in Israel is much more combative than the United States. In the United States, scholars generally are diplomatic and gracious to each other, even if they violently hold different ideas. In Israel, these things normally become personal. And it's a much more aggressive way of talking at scholarly conferences and things like that, and in seminars and graduate school and universities. And these two scholars had different interpretations of this section of the Genesis Apocryphon. But the key to their difference was how they thought a line should read where the text was going and illegible. Their difference of opinion hinged on a line they couldn't read where they both hypothetically filled in that line differently. So when we applied the multispectral imaging in the scroll, they both showed up to see what they could see. And they're standing there at that moment when in real time, slides into the camera, boom, legible text. And these two did not like each other. I mean, this was sort of a moment of truth, just to stand and look at the computer screen in harmony for a moment. And of course, it showed a text that neither of them had guessed they would say in that line, and sort of beat back both of their interpretations. They both had to go to school again. And one of them actually teared up when he saw the line, and they both shook hands, and, well, then probably came up with some other way to defend their interpretation, even in light of the new information. Because that's what scholars sometimes do. Well, I have to do the commercial. Okay, I direct the Early Manuscripts Electronic Library. There's a sign-up sheet in the back, along with the sign-up sheets for the class. One says the name of my organization if you'd like to receive our newsletter. But multispectral imaging for the last 10 years has been used. It gives fuzzy images, and it's hit or miss as to whether you can actually get something out of it. But it's improved, and my organization is now in conversation with a scientific team that includes scientists from Rochester Institute of Technology and Boeing. And they've advanced the science of multispectral imaging. Can you see this?
Would you like the light turned
off? We're going to have to. There's only a few slides. I think we need to go without the lights for a moment. Okay, it's still not great. This manuscript is a palimpsest called the Archimedes Palimpsest. It's Greek. The top layer is a medieval prayer book of the Greek Orthodox Church. The bottom layer is treatises of the famous mathematician Archimedes, the guy who ran through Athens, as they say, yelling Eureka. You've probably heard of it. Now, the underlying text in this palimpsest that was erased is the world's only copy of some treatises by Archimedes. And when you made a palimpsest, you'd erase the parchment, and you'd turn the parchment 90 degrees. So the old text wouldn't interfere with the new text too much, since it's going perpendicular to the new text. But this manuscript is the prayer book. Now with the text vertical, just turn it that way for the image. This, and you can see it better on a computer screen that's not projected by a projector on the screen, but there are diagrams in the margins of the Archimedes text. Indeed, and now, for the first time, we can read these treatises by Archimedes. This is a section, actually, of a philosopher named Hyperides, also in this palimpsest, whose writings were mostly lost. And this, right now, was just seen in August for the first time, text from Hyperides. And the prayer book is in white, going vertically, and the text of Hyperides is going horizontal, black. First time that text has ever been seen. Well, this is me and a bunch of other people meeting with the scholars. Fascinating photo. the light source that's used for multispectral imaging. If it doesn't look like a light bulb to you, we're using LEDs, light emission diodes, and those are what they use for stoplights nowadays, LEDs. But we can get LEDs that only illuminate a very narrow, they're focused on a very narrow bandwidth of the spectrum of light. And then we will actually tune the LEDs to the spectral characteristics of a particular manuscript and the inks that are on it to try to make it as legible as possible. And so the manuscript is illuminated with these LEDs with different colors. And then the software will combine these images to try to produce an image that's legible. Now, so far, multispectral imaging has been a very cumbersome technology. It's difficult to take with you. And what we're doing right now is integrating this technology with the manuscript cradle you saw last week, so that we can put a fragile manuscript in a cradle, only open 90 degrees, and we only handle that manuscript once. And we take visible light images, what it looks like to the naked eye, and multispectral images, and manage that fragile manuscript in our cradle, so we can do both kinds of imaging with palimpsest and protect the fragile binding of the manuscript. And that's what we're working on right now. But that's my commercial. And we did some Dead Sea Scrolls too, so that's good. Now, quickly to introduce us to the Dead Sea Scrolls again. You've seen this map. Northwestern edge of the Dead Sea, where the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. The community of Qumran. This community was founded at about 125 BCE. 125 BCE, destroyed by the Romans in AD 68. 2 years before the Romans would destroy what city? Jerusalem would be destroyed in 70. We believe the Romans destroyed the Qumran settlement at about 68 AD, because we know the movements of a Roman general at the time, and it corresponds. And the people of Qumran did the smart thing. When you see the Roman army coming in your direction, you run the other way. When they excavated the settlement, there were no skeletons with Roman arrowheads sitting in the body cavity, which is what you find if people try to defend themselves against Romans. They fled, and when the archaeologists excavated the settlement between 1951 and 1956, in the pantry next to the dining hall that was 72 feet long, where all of the members of the community who were ritually pure would meet for lunch every day at noon, the pantry next door still had plates, clayware clay plates, neatly stacked in dozens, ready to be used. We found earthenware, we found cooking vessels carved from stone. Now, does anyone know why would you carve a cooking vessel from stone rather than using clay, which was much more inexpensive and easier to work with? It's a trick question. Not a trick question, but a difficult one. The reason is because in some theories of Judaism from the time of Jesus, I can't explain why, but vessels made from stone communicated impurity, ritual impurity, uncleanness, less readily than vessels made out of ceramics, made out of clay. And so much of their cookware had been carved in stone because it was believed to handle liquids in a way that would maintain ritual purity of the community. When an archaeologist digs a village or a city in this part of the world, there are two things that will tell them if this is a Jewish settlement as opposed to a Gentile settlement. One is the cookware. Do they have cookware that's carved from stone? And the second is the presence of mikvahs, those ritual baths that I talked about last week that are found in Qumran. I'm going to mention this scroll again. This is a scroll of the Book of Leviticus. It's what we think a Dead Sea Scroll should look like. The only complete Dead Sea Scroll, 22 feet long, the Book of Isaiah. But this is what most scholars think of when they think of a Dead Sea Scroll. It's tiny fragments. We talked about this last week. Now we'll get to some new slides. There's some facts I left out sort of in introducing the scrolls last week. From when do they date and how do scholars date a Dead Sea Scroll? Most of the Dead Sea Scrolls date to the century immediately preceding the birth of Jesus. 100 BCE to the turn of the eras, to the birth of Jesus, that last century before Christ. A minority of the scrolls are older. We have Dead Sea Scrolls that have been dated to as early as 250 BCE. 250 BCE, the oldest biblical manuscripts in existence. Matter of fact, all of the Dead Sea Scrolls that are biblical are the oldest biblical manuscripts in the world. These ones that are very old, going back to 250 BC, there's a copy of the book of Jeremiah, a copy of the book of Exodus, and a copy of the book of 1 Samuel. Samuel, it's one book really, but Samuel, that are on these 250 BC scrolls. How do you date a Dead Sea Scroll? The first thing was coins found in the caves. And you know that if you dig something up in the modern world and you find coins, and the last coin is dated 1975, and there are no coins after 1975, then most likely this house that burnt down, say, burnt down in 1975 or maybe 1976 or 77. So dating by coins is fairly secure to give you the time period in which this community lived and compiled and wrote a library that we know of as the Dead Sea Scrolls. A second way of dating was through radiocarbon 14. Taking a little snip off of a Dead Sea Scroll and the chemical test for radiocarbon 14. But prior to both of those means of dating, well, not prior to the coins, but prior to radiocarbon 14, was the orthography. How are the scrolls written? We have a lot of later Hebrew manuscripts, and I mentioned last week a little papyrus manuscript discovered in Egypt called the Dash Papyrus. And we have some Jewish texts in Aramaic from, interestingly, Jewish mercenaries that were employed by the Egyptian government in about 400 BC in Egypt. And they have some scrolls that we found to about 400 BC. But what it means is the way people write changes over time. And we have some papyrus scraps of Jewish writing in Egypt that are older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. Within the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves, we have more than 300 years of Jewish writing. And we can tell an older Dead Sea Scroll from a later Dead Sea Scroll because you, once you study them, you can put them in order and reconstruct how the writing of Hebrew changed through the time period of the people who lived in the Dead Sea Scrolls community. But of course, they brought with them scrolls that were already about 125 years old when they founded their community in about 125 BC. And then we have Dead Sea Scrolls that appear to have been copied right up to the point they were destroyed by the Romans. There are about 900 Dead Sea Scrolls, about 900 of them. They divide neatly into three categories. There are biblical manuscripts, and last count, there were 259 biblical manuscripts among the 900 Dead Sea Scrolls. 259 manuscripts, every book of the Old Testament except for the book of Esther, was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Oldest biblical manuscripts in existence. And we'll talk about that more because one of the areas where Dead Sea Scrolls have changed scholarship is we have rewritten our understanding of the early history of the Bible, how the Bible came together based on the scrolls. Then there are two other categories of Dead Sea Scrolls. One of them is general Jewish literature. Literature that all Jews of the time period would have known. Most of those are not in Hebrew, they're in Aramaic, which was the general spoken language in the Jewish homes of the time period of Jesus. General Jewish literature, which was literature that Jesus would have known, that the writers of the New Testament would have known, but almost all of that is new to us today and discovered for the first time in the Dead Sea Scrolls. Then there's a third category, sectarian literature. This was a little group of people in the desert who believed that the priests of the temple were not keeping the temple adequately ritually clean, as we discussed last week. So they removed themselves in the desert to realize their distinctive vision of what it meant to be Jewish, with a far more strict interpretation of Torah than at the temple in Jerusalem. And so, like any sect, any separatist group, they developed a jargon. They developed a distinctive set of ideas. And they wrote scrolls for internal consumption, sectarian literature. And interestingly, those are in Hebrew. And they're in the Hebrew of the Bible. Because Hebrew changed over the centuries, how it's spoken, every language evolves. But these people thought, we are the true Israel. All those other Jews in Jerusalem, they're the false Israel. We are the heirs of the promises of the prophets. We are keeping Torah adequately and accurately. The others aren't. So in their literature, it's sort of like sort of being in a down-home Baptist church and everybody is praying "Be it now." They used archaic-sounding language to imitate the Bible to say, we are the heirs of the promises of the prophets. We're the true Israel. Okay, I need to keep going. This is a scroll of the book of Psalms that we'll talk about in our last session when we talk about the Bible. There were 39 copies of the book of Psalms discovered in the scrolls. More copies than any other book of the Bible. Psalms was popular then, just like it's popular today. My professor at Claremont, James Sanders, had the privilege to unroll this scroll. He used a camel hair brush, a penknife, and then he had a humidifier to loosen the parchment. And the humidifier was like a great big glass hourglass. You put a wet sponge in the bottom and the scroll on the top, or is it the other way around? But you sealed it for a few moments to let the scroll loosen in the humidity so you could unroll it. And he was having trouble unrolling it, and the chief editor of the Dead Sea Scrolls said, only put it in this humidifier for so many minutes, I don't know, 20 minutes at a time, never longer. And Jim Sanders, my professor, who was all of about 28 years old at the time, and was a rising star in biblical studies with excellent language skills, was getting frustrated. He left a tea kettle on and put the manuscript in the humidifier and went to lunch. And lucky for him, it wasn't damaged. But in 7 days, he was unable to unroll the scroll, and he says he will never forget how bad it smelled. These are two columns of that Psalm scroll. Notice, and it's not upside down. Hebrew always looks like it's upside down because you write from right to left. But you see two columns. We're missing the top and the bottom of the scroll from deterioration. All we have is the core. We have 39 biblical Psalms on this scroll. We only have the core. We have the end of the book of Psalms, missing the top and bottom. Everything else deteriorated except the middle of the scroll. And notice the scribe made errors and had to correct his errors. But that is the scribe correcting his own errors. This is a manuscript. I know it doesn't look like just another Dead Sea Scroll to you, but this is one of the so we have biblical manuscripts, and then we have non-sectarian general Jewish literature. This is one of those. It's called the Songs of Sabbath Sacrifice. A copy was also found at Masada, by the way, and we know, therefore, it was general Jewish literature, not just a Qumran. It gives a different song to be sung every Sabbath of the year. Now, what's distinctive is the songs aren't to be sung by human choirs. They're to be sung by angelic choirs. And the theology underlying this scroll is that in heaven, there is a temple in heaven. The heavenly temple is prior. The earthly temple is derivative of the heavenly temple. And the prayers and sacrifices that occur in the earthly temple only have meaning to the degree that they are derivative of the heavenly sacrifices and prayers. And so you have to do your prayers and sacrifices according to the same, at the same time, in the same procedure as the angels in heaven. And again, the Qumranites thought the priests of the temple weren't being strict enough, so they felt the priests of the temple were getting out of sync with the angelic temple. Now you read the book of Hebrews in the New Testament, and it says we have a more superior sacrifice to the sacrifice that occurs in the temple, all the many sacrifices in the temple, and Jesus' sacrifice occurred in a more superior temple, in a heavenly temple. Where does the book of Hebrews in the New Testament get that set of ideas that it's pulling on to communicate Jesus to its culture? It's getting us from the theology that we now see the background of in scrolls like this. This is a sectarian scroll. It's a sectarian scroll. They wrote commentaries on all the prophetic books. And scholars call them Pesher documents because they quote a verse or just a sample from a prophetic book. This is a commentary on Habakkuk, one of the minor prophets, that nobody ever reads, but there's really good stuff in. But Habakkuk They quote a section of Habakkuk, then they say Pesher, which is a Hebrew word that basically means interpretation, and they give their interpretation. And they believe that the prophetic books of the Bible, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Ezekiel, had two meanings. There was a public, literal meaning available to everyone who read it, available to all Jews who read the plain meaning of the text. But they believed there was an esoteric meaning that God had vouchsafed only to the leadership of their community. And so in these commentaries on the prophets, they're elucidating the esoteric meaning that was theirs alone to know. I'll talk about this scroll later, but it's another sectarian scroll called the Rule of the Congregation. And we need some lights. Any questions? We have three categories of Dead Sea Scrolls, dating from 250 BCE, some biblical manuscripts, all the way up to 68 AD when the community was destroyed. Biblical manuscripts, general Jewish literature, sectarian literature. Any questions before I go on? Hank?
You mentioned the three types, and you mentioned the sectarian. Last week you said that we learned a lot of things that we never knew anything about. Did we know anything at all about that sectarian writing until the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Nothing. There's a very interesting place in, is it 1st or 2nd Corinthians? There my memory fails me, but it's either one of those two letters of Paul, where scholars could tell Paul was quoting another document. Because his vocabulary changes, and it's absolutely clear that Paul is quoting something. And even the theology of what he's quoting is a little bit weird for Paul. It's consistent with the point he's making in the letter, but Paul is drifting and he's quoting somebody else. And the language of that, this section of 1st or 2nd Corinthians where Paul is quoting something, talks about light and darkness, and it talks about the competing forces of light versus the competing forces of darkness. And we go to the sectarian literature of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and throughout that sectarian literature you find the forces of light are arrayed against the forces of darkness in their sectarian literature. And it appears that Paul may have known some of the sectarian literature from Qumran, and that's what he was quoting. Paul would disagree with this community of Qumran on all sorts of things. His ideas and their ideas were very different, but it appears that he knew some of their literature, and he found reason to quote part of it. But that's the only place where we could say that before the discovery of the scrolls, we knew any of their sectarian literature. There's this quote from Paul, which we couldn't understand very well until we found the Dead Sea Scrolls. Any other questions before we go on? And if it's a question we're going to handle later, we'll just move on. Right in here.
How did you handle the quarter-inch thick, like a rock, scroll 15 feet long to under the canvas?
The Dead Sea Scrolls vary. How did we handle a piece that was rigid and a quarter inch thick and solid black that's 15 feet long? Actually, all of the scrolls that are long were flexible because they were discovered as a scroll and they could be unrolled. And so you had a case like the Great Isaiah Scroll, 22 feet long, and it could be unrolled. And I said last week that John Trevor, the American scholar, unrolled it on his bed in his dormitory. Where he was a young PhD working in Jerusalem. And even today, that scroll looks great. They've removed the linen thread that ties the pieces together because you don't want to take a 2,000-year-old scroll and keep rolling and unrolling it, but it looks great. And then you find these other scrolls that are solid, cold, black, and rigid. But all of those are fragmentary. I don't know of any rigid piece of a scroll that's about bigger than that, bigger than the palm of my hand. And the Genesis Apocryphon that's gelatinizing is just that, it's gelatinizing. It's actually too flexible. So you have all these, one or two more questions. Connor in the back, you have a question?
How many Dead Sea Scrolls has your company examined?
Say again?
How many Dead Sea Scrolls has your company examined?
Oh, well, it was with a previous employer that I worked with the Dead Sea Scrolls. So zero. But with my previous employer, the Ancient Biblical Manuscript Center in Claremont, we took about 900 multispectral images, and there were probably 30 25 to 30 scrolls represented those images, all of which were the worst case scenarios among the Dead Sea Scrolls in terms of illegibility and deterioration. About 25.
Did you mention Archimedes?
Yeah, that's not a Dead Sea Scroll. That's just a different manuscript with all the
scrolls.
One more question, then we'll jump to a new topic. Green
shoes. No, the Dead Sea Scrolls weren't written on parchment. Were any of the scrolls a second copy?
Thank you. One, the Dead Sea Scrolls are on parchment and papyrus. That's a basic fact introduced. We have parchment scrolls and papyrus scrolls. And although a parchment scroll, the leather, the animal hide is tan, which removes acids from the skin that makes it last longer. The Dead Sea Scrolls were simply scraped of hair and dried. And one of the reasons they deteriorated so badly is probably because oils were left in the skins. But animal hide and papyrus Dead Sea Scrolls, and we do have Dead Sea Scrolls that are multiple copies of the same document, and it's pretty clear that some of them can have a parentage. This scroll is a copy of that scroll, which is a copy of that scroll. We do have places where it looks like we can reconstruct the scribal activity in the community and see them copying the same document over and over again. Let's move on. What do we have to talk about with the Dead Sea Scrolls? Last week, we talked about the Dead Sea Scrolls in the 20th century. We need to finish that topic, and then we'll move to your handout. Last week, we talked about the discovery of the scrolls. They were discovered in 11 caves between 1947 and 1956. Of the 11 caves, which cave was the mother lode? Two-thirds of the scrolls from one cave. Cave number 4, person in the back got it first.
Okay.
First in line for refreshments. But cave number 4 was the mother lode with 600 Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, who discovered most of those caves? The Bedouin. Now, and it's only been recently the scholars have started to recognize the contributions of the Bedouin to this. They have always been sort of the people that were shunted to the side. But most recently, scholars in articles about the history of the discovery have started to give them credit. Because they actually handled the material well, and they proved themselves sort of honorable in their dealings with this material, and without them, we wouldn't have it. And the one Bedouin named Muhammad Adib, who was the first discoverer of cave number 1 in 1947, he died of cancer a few years ago. And when he was dying, he wrote letters, because he didn't profit at all. The Bedouins got some profit. It was the intermediaries, the Palestinians who set themselves up as intermediaries between the Bedouin and the Jordanian government, who made profit from the scrolls. But Muhammad Adib was dying, and he wrote letters. He had no health insurance. And he wrote letters to Western scholars who worked on the scrolls, asking them to provide funds for his medical care. And he never received an answer back from anyone to whom he wrote a letter. And I don't know if they received the letters. I don't know. But he never received an answer back. And he died saying he didn't believe that God led him to the scrolls. He believed that a jinn led him to the scrolls. That's actually where we get the word genie. But a jinn is sort of a mischievous spirit that appears in some Muslim texts. And Muslim fables and stories mention jinns, which are mischievous spirits. He believed a mischievous spirit showed him to the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the scrolls were found by Bedouin. Most of the 11 caves, the scrolls were published in a decent amount of time. But cave 4, they appointed 8 editors, 2 Brits, 2 Americans, 2 French, 2 German, 4 of them Roman Catholic, 4 of them Protestant. Who was missing? There were no Jewish editors, whether Israeli or not, and the reason was, at the time, these were Jordanian scrolls. East Jerusalem, the museum where they were, was a Palestinian museum, and the Jordanians had just fought a war against Israel, and therefore refused to have Jewish editors participate. Now, cave 4, though, it's the problem that made the media. In the late 80s and early 90s, the problem where the scrolls entered the media was cave 4. Because the scholars had too much to do. 8 people, about 600 fragmentary scrolls. Only one scroll came out of cave 4, still in the form of a scroll. Because none of the scrolls in cave 4 were in jars. They were the little fragments, the Dead Sea McNuggets that was in one of the slides. And it's estimated there were 15,000 fragments, making 600 scrolls from cave 4. The greatest jigsaw puzzle that humanity has ever faced was cave 4. I mentioned last week, but K4 was discovered in September of 1952. In early 1953, the editors were appointed. John D. Rockefeller paid for their work. And by 1960, they had basically reconstructed and transcribed the text of all of K4 by 1960. They were doing stellar work. And if they had just they couldn't photocopy in 1960, but if they had put on one of those blue machines, whatever, but if they had distributed their notebooks, they would have been heroes. But the editor-in-chief, who was not one of the eight, encouraged them to try to say the last word about every scroll in their group. Each of them had a section of scrolls from K4 they were in charge with, not scrolls, piles of fragments they were in charge of, and they were encouraged to try to say everything about it. And colleagues who knew the editor said these guys were almost obsessed. They had to look up and understand each Dead Sea Scroll in the history of Jewish thought, in the history of Christian thought. How did the language of the scroll fit into the history of Hebrew letters and Hebrew writing? And no individual could do that. There are rumors that the Vatican was involved. There was no oversight, and no one was stepping in to slow them down. And actually, part of the problem was there was no oversight. There was no accountability, and therefore everyone dreams they can do more in a limited amount of time than they could really do. And no one had authority over them. The Vatican did not intercede to slow down publication. It was human, it was mundane why the Dead Sea Scrolls weren't published. Human arrogance, belief you can get more done than you can, possessiveness, these are my Dead Sea Scrolls I'm publishing, the belief you can say the last word about anything, those are the reasons the Dead Sea Scrolls from K4, 40 years after their discovery, were still unpublished. And other scholars weren't given access. Let me turn to my book. I don't have the right section of notes. In 1977, 87, 40 years after the discovery, Geza Vermesh, a scholar in Oxford, held the Dead Sea Scrolls conference. I mentioned him last week. He would have gotten his PhD when the scrolls were discovered, but was in retiring, in approaching retirement, and still had not seen the unpublished scrolls. And at the conference, with the editors in front of him, he convened the conference and gave these words in his speech opening the Dead Sea Scrolls conference. The charge of weakness or procrastination on the part of the editor-in-chief, the person in charge of those eight editors, would be lifted from his shoulders, and the other editors also would escape being accused of displaying a kind of proprietary attitude toward an immense cultural treasure, whose trustees they are, but which in fact belongs to us all. And then he asked them to immediately release their notes without further commentary on the scrolls. Strugnell, who was then editor-in-chief, a man named John Strugnell, responded later in an article, "Instead of complaining about our slowness, I would suggest that scholars devote themselves to a careful reading of the books which have already been published." Yeah. "I'm a scholar writing a book about Judaism before Jesus. And there are 600 scrolls giving evidence of Judaism before Jesus that I can't see. How do I ever finish my book? How do I devote myself to what's already been published when it's insufficient?" So there was a problem. The scholars started arguing with each other. But here's the best statement I have of really why was this material unpublished. It's by David Noel Friedman, who teaches at UC San Diego, who was not one of the K4 editors. And by the way, I've met some of the K4 editors. They're nice people. They're good scholars. These aren't criminals. It's just bad human psychology reaching horrible results. But David Noel Friedman was given that scroll of the Book of Leviticus, which was in a slide, the one that has the hills and valleys on the top. That was his scroll to publish. It's a Book of Leviticus in good condition. This is easy to publish. Of all the scrolls, this one you can publish. And David Noel Friedman, who's a wonderful person, if you've ever had a chance to meet him, one of my favorite people, actually, in Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship, He wrote, after having let that Dead Sea Scroll languish for a long time and not publishing it, "I write as a guilty party. Since I was assigned responsibility for the Leviticus scroll from Cave 11 about 10 years ago, there have been some diplomatic and other complications. But basically, the reason this document has not been published is that I was overloaded with other obligations and commitments which claimed my time. That is not an excuse, and I should either have published the scroll or returned it to the team for reassignment. Many, if not most, scholars harbor optimistic delusions about what they can and will do in the way of productive writing." Just like me. "And even after observing many colleagues fall into the pit, I have followed the same primrose path." So what happens? And here we need to accelerate. I hope I haven't done too much review. A lot of new faces, so I tried to do some. You get to the late 80s, and there's a fever pitch about this. The Dead Sea Scrolls are on the cover of Time magazine again, not with articles about interesting things they say, but with scholars screaming at each other. I mentioned John Strugnell called the scholars who wanted access gnats that were biting them. And they're on the cover of New York Times. What is going to happen? Three things happen simultaneously. One, the institute I used to direct in Claremont called the Ancient Biblical Manuscript Center. In 1980, they contracted with the government of Israel to send a photographer to Jerusalem to copy all of the negatives of the Dead Sea Scrolls taken when they were first discovered. Because when a museum receives new antiquities, the museum photographs them. And the Palestine Archaeological Museum in East Jerusalem photographed the Dead Sea Scrolls as they were brought in and purchased from the Bedouin and the Bedouin's intermediaries by the Jordanian government. They photographed all of the scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls were brought from a cave to Jerusalem, which is more humid and wet. They were handled. Deterioration accelerated. Those negatives now are what scholars rely on for reading the Dead Sea Scrolls, are those negatives. They're not precious. So they contracted with the government of Israel, that now controlled East Jerusalem, to go duplicate all of those negatives, to put a copy in cold storage here in Southern California to preserve those negatives for future generations. But the Manuscript Center signed a contract with the government of Israel, who inherited the bad politics of the editors from the Jordanians before them, not to release any of the unpublished scrolls. So they went into cold storage. But the Manuscript Center had a board of trustees, like all nonprofits do, with one donor and scholars filling out the rest of the board. You don't have to read books on the composition of nonprofit boards to realize one donor is present on the board, everyone else is a non-donor, could lead to problems in an organization. Well, a disagreement did occur between the scholars who filled the board and the one donor who sat as president of the board. So that one donor decided to resign from the board. At the same time that the photographer was in Jerusalem capturing the images, duplicating the negatives. So when the photographer, and it's amazing how much of this happened in Southern California, the photographer returns to LAX. This donor and former president of the organization meets him at the airport and says, "Don't take the negatives to the Manuscript Center in Claremont. Take them to the Huntington Library outside of Pasadena, San Marino, right? Take them to the Huntington Library instead." And if you remember the Huntington Library being involved, this is how they got involved. Now, this donor didn't own the negatives. The project was paid for by the National Endowment for the Humanities, the NEH. The contract was between the Manuscript Center in Claremont, a nonprofit corporation, and the government of Israel. So the negatives were stolen and taken to the Huntington. So the government of Israel wrote letters to the Huntington. The center in Claremont wrote letters to the Huntington, all saying, "Release the negatives, they're purloined. You can't have them." And the Huntington held up its hands and said, "You need to resolve your dispute with your former board member. Until then, the negatives will sit right here." I think she might have been a donor to the Huntington as well. Now, so, and most of these are all good people, by the way. I sometimes draw a laugh line out of it, but these are good people. But in 3 years, the disagreement was resolved, and the Manuscript Center, the director, drove his station wagon, picked up the negatives in 1983, and drove them back to the Huntington, and drove them back to the Manuscript Center in Claremont, California. And my friend, who was that former director, asked the director of the Huntington, "Do you have any negatives of the scrolls remaining at the Huntington?" No. He said he asked him three times, sort of like Peter denying Christ. I don't think the director knew. I don't think he would lie. But the director didn't know that the photographer had made a tertiary set of the negatives. Originals in Jerusalem, secondary made a tertiary set that stayed at the Huntington. So that happens all in 1983. You get to the late 80s, and people are screaming at each other about access to the scrolls. The Huntington Library realizes their board of trustees learns they have a set of negatives. And they have no agreement, like the Manuscript Center in Claremont, obligating them not to release them. They're just sitting there. Of course, they're not supposed to have them. But if they release them, who's going to sue them? The negatives were taken by a Palestinian photographer at a Jordanian-controlled museum called the Palestine Archaeological Museum. Since the 1967 war, Israel controls East Jerusalem and that museum and the scrolls. Who is going to step into those diplomatic waters and sue anybody? And even if Israel decided to sue, can you imagine them with their tourism ads saying, come for 7 days and six nights in the Holy Land, we will suppress archaeological information that's important to your faith, whether Jewish or Christian. So the Huntington Library thought about it and said, there is more scholarly merit in releasing them than a threat of suit of keeping them hidden. Their board is discussing this. In the meantime, Israel decides to deposit a set of prints from the negatives. Not the negatives themselves, but prints, paper prints made from the negatives, and deposit them at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati as another sort of go-down, as it's called, a place to preserve the data. But no one was to look at them. They were literally locked up at the campus of Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati. But they sent with the scrolls a concordance of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I mentioned this last week. You may be familiar with the Bible Concordance. It lists every word in the Bible in alphabetical order. So every time the word Father occurs in the Bible, from Genesis 1 to the end of Revelation, is listed. And it gives you the word before and the word after. The Cave 4 editors made a concordance of all the fragments from Cave 4 to help them shuffle and sort all those fragments. Well, the concordance came with the prints that were put on reserve in locked storage at Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, which is a rabbinical seminary. But the cards of the concordance were put on reserve in the reference section of the library. And a young graduate student named Marty Abag, who since finished his PhD there, looked at it and said, this is all the text of the Cave 4 fragments that are unpublished. And it gives me a word and the next word. I look up that word on a card, and the card concordance, I get the next word. The reason I can reconstruct the scrolls. And Marty realized that his advisor, who was becoming legally blind, as he got older, who was a Dead Sea Scroll scholar by the name of Ben Zion Bachholder, would die and never read K4. He wouldn't die and never read K4. His vision would continue to deteriorate, and he'd never read K4. So Marty said, if I type all this into my computer, and Marty's kind of a computer guy, I can reconstruct K4. Then there was Robert Eisenman, who teaches at Cal State Long Beach. Again, another California reference in this. Robert Eisenman is actually a scholar of Islam, but he concluded Dead Sea Scrolls in introduction to Bible classes that he taught at Cal State Long Beach, no introductory level classes for freshmen who want to learn an academic view of the Bible. And he taught himself Hebrew, and most of his ideas about the Dead Sea Scrolls are considered sort of fringe at best. But he was a guy who kept pounding. He actually threatened to sue Israel for absence. And Eisenman started receiving negatives of the Dead Sea Scrolls in his mailbox at home of the unpublished Dead Sea Scrolls, anonymously. Negatives of the unpublished Dead Sea Scrolls. How are we doing?
Close. 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. Let's, I feel we're ending at the same place we ended last week, almost. Except I've added more to the story. Let's go get some coffee and cookies. We'll finish everything I set out to do tonight. But let's take 10 minutes, and we'll come back and finish the story.